I'm Dan Nicasso with the Honolulu Advertiser, and we're sitting with Celine Pi'ilani Nelson, President and Founder of Pacific Leadership Partners. Good afternoon.
Aloha.
Tell me what Pacific Leadership Partners is.
Pacific Leadership Partners is a firm that I established last year as a means of bridging modern-day philosophy with regards to leadership, self-empowerment, and those wonderful touchy-feely esoteric things that is pretty big on the market right now. You know, everyone's writing about emotional intelligence and all this stuff, but after sitting through countless hours of leadership development, I found that there was a need to add in the cultural aspect as to why Hawaii is so special, because we are different. You know, when people come here, you know, the first thing that they can feel is a spirit, but no one's really been able to touch it or put a face to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the same with business, that there's a certain way that we do business here, which is different. And what was that? And my whole goal of Pacific Leadership Partners is to be able to be what I call myself as like a bridge maker. You know, how do I bridge that? You know, and uplift and inspire local people to reach and attain higher goals, you know, and how do you offer a little bit of tolerance training for those people that come here and see Hawaii as still native, you know, and how do you make give it a face and a voice? So that's what we're about.
Mm-hmm. And it's intended for both, like you said, the Malihini, as well as people who want to step up a little bit and take more of a leadership role?
It really is.
Who is the intended?
The intended audience is every human being who just wants to become a better human being. You know, the way society is right now, and I talk as if I'm 75 years old, I know that. But I remember when life was much simpler, when people still had honor and integrity mm-hmm. in what they did. And I miss that. And if I have a chance to try and instill that in the younger generations coming up, we might just be able to revert back to where we once were. I'm sure we're never going to get back to where we were, but at least we can instill those same values,
mm-hmm.
you know, those old style values.
But is it designed for business leaders, organizational leaders, nonprofits?
Everybody.
Just the leaders.
Not just leaders. Because we've actually, in our classes, we've had audiences from the front line all the way up to presidents and business owners,
mm-hmm.
and they get it. Because one of the things that we actually stress in our classes, we offer actually two parts of our company, which is public sessions, and then we also do in-house consulting. But we always tell people, when you come to our sessions, you take that label or that title that you've got, and you drop it in that imaginary box outside the door, and you come in on the same playing field as everybody else,
mm-hmm.
and it works. You know, people get the same message. And it's kind of inspiring to see that, you know, that you can have the mailroom guy from Company A sitting next to the president of Company B,
mm-hmm.
and they're just great friends sharing experiences.
And what are they talking about, or what are they listening to?
Well, it depends on which session that they're in, because our sessions range from leadership to empowerment,
mm-hmm.
To social styles, you know, social behaviors, mastering emotional intelligence, all that stuff. So it just depends. But majority of the peer-to-peer coaching and the table discussions basically circulate around people sharing their own experiences related to a specific topic. So I'll throw that topic out there or a question, and then I'll have them share their own experiences because people learn from each other.
Like what kind of a topic or question?
For example, one of the classes that I do is based off of a book I wrote called No Matter What, and I pose this one question. That the first thing that I believe that lends to a person's personal balance is the ability to appreciate and love themselves no matter what. Because if you can identify with that and just kind of love yourself and appreciate the talents that you bring to the table, you'll be able to embrace other people. You know, whether you're in a leadership role, a parental role, it doesn't matter. Because a lot of times people who are mad at the world are the ones that have a difficult time connecting with people. So I will pose that question. It says, tell your neighbor what it is that you love about yourself.
Hmm.
You know, and they sort of just look at me and I'm like, well, there's so many, you know? And I tell them straight up, it's nothing about, you know, staying humble or anything like that. Just tell them what it is that you appreciate that you bring to the table.
Isn't that hard for local people to do?
It is, and that's why, you know, get them out of their box, their comfort zone.
Yeah.
You know, and they start to go, well, yeah, you know, I cook a perfect pot of rice every night. And it's like, oh, well, that's great, because not all of us can do that.
Yeah,
you know?
That's like, okay. And we'll get back to the nuts and bolts, but
okay.
Some of what you're saying and some of what I read, it sounds like you borrow some from Tony Robbins, some from Glenn, some...
Well, actually, no.
Are these all developed?
All of my programs, all of my curriculum is curriculum that I've developed, with the exception of the Tutu Who Am I session, which is Social Styles. That's actually a licensed program. But what I've tried to do is actually, for every concept that I develop, there are other concepts that are parallel to it.
Okay.
And most of the Western concepts are stemming from what I call the same kumos. Tony Robbins, Ken Blanchard, Stephen Covey, all of them. And what I've tried to do is not necessarily borrow or copy, but more validate the Hawaiian aspect of it. Like, for example, the whole idea of kuleana. Okay. Kuleana in Hawaiian is responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And within an ancient culture, kuleana is actually very important with regards to, you know, being a parent, being an ali'i, being, you know, just a commoner. And that same theory of taking responsibility for oneself is pretty much pervasive in all these leadership books by all these other guys, Tony Robbins, Ken Blanchard, and what have you. So what I do is, with every cultural aspect that I teach, I find the Western parallel for it, to bridge it, to show that, hey, I just didn't make it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's kind of substantiated by some of our Western gurus.
Right.
Yeah, so that's basically the extent of that. With regards to Glenn's work, I honor the fact that he has served as such a great mentor and giving us the experience to have been able to sort of grow with him and, you know, see the trials and tribulations and the triumphs that he's made throughout his process, you know, and we're still great friends, which is kind of cool. And it's a real blessing to have been able to have sat in the seat that I've been able to sit in. And together with my assistant and marketing director, Allison. You know, very few have that opportunity.
Okay. Let's get through these. these are our boilerplate questions.
Okay.
How old are you?
Do I have to tell you that? No, I'm just kidding. actually, I'm 40. 40 years old.
How's that? Just
made 40.
Well, happy birthday.
When's your birthday? December.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm only, 6 months old, 40.
40 years and 6 months.
Yeah.
And your title is President and Founder. And you were, where were you born?
I was born in Lihue, Kauai.
What was your family doing there?
I'm actually from Kauai.
Yeah, I mean, what was your family doing on Kauai?
What
did they do for a living?
My dad is actually in the Air National Guard.
Oh.
He retired from there, and he's now with the Civil Service at Barking Sands. And my mom is a business owner. She's like the only... cell phone, faceplate dealership on the island. So yeah, she's a monopolist.
Uh-huh. And where'd you go to high school?
I went to Kauai High School.
What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1983. You had to ask her a question. That's why I'm an 80s fanatic. I am old school.
College.
College. I attended BYU, Hawaii campus here.
BYUH?
BYUH. Uh-huh. As well as KCC.
Uh-huh.
And then I have a travel industry degree that I got in 1986, because back then it was all about tourism.
Right.
You know, and computers really weren't heard of back then, so no one really thought of going into that field. And as you can see right now, I decided, and everybody thinks I'm actually kind of crazy, but I actually love it. I am actually back in school right now as we speak.
Really?
So I'm a student at HPU.
And okay, where was your Tim school degree from?
From KCC.
Okay, and where are you going to school now?
Hawaii Pacific University.
Sorry. What are you studying there?
Business. International business.
International.
And I want to learn Chinese.
Really? How come? Emerging market?
Emerging market, you know, and you just look at... What I'm finding right now, which is kind of cool, is when you teach... I teach this one class called Social Styles. And Social Styles basically breaks this up into, you know, four types of social behaviors. I'm starting to see certain types of styles prominent in certain types of ethnicities. You know, and I'm thinking that if I can really master international business, I'll be able to see all of the different styles come to play in that.
Where is that?
It's about class. Diversity. It's actually... this class right here.
Who am I?
It's a psychological profile that you take that will determine how people view your exhibited behaviors. Because if you do a self-assessment, you're running a 45% error ratio. You know, because the way you see yourself is different from how others see you.
Yeah.
So what we do here, this one is actually the forefather of like Myers-Briggs and FIRO-B. So it's the actual model built in 1930. And what we do with this class is, this class enables us to, one, understand why people are different. We do it intuitively, you know, but it gives us a science, you know, how to become more understanding, how to talk to people according to their voice, not necessarily our voice.
Mm.
You know, and then how do you create rapport and get to win-win much faster?
And so, speaking Chinese again?
Oh, speaking Chinese. Well, what I'm trying to do is I'm actually trying to learn more of what the world brings to the table.
Ah.
You know, and if I can understand the culture, I can understand the social behaviors. If I can understand the social behaviors, I can then understand how it all plays into business.
Gotcha.
And I get a better handle on it.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. And where are you taking the Chinese from?
I haven't actually sought out a good Chinese speaking class yet. So if you know of anybody...
I mean, are you going to take it from somebody you know? Or
I'm probably going to take it from... I want to actually see if I can take it through an authentic type of Chinese school. You know, like how you had Japanese
immersion.
School, Chinese immersion school.
Yeah,
I want to look, because then you get real hands-on.
Yeah, and it becomes also about the culture and rituals. And
yeah, it's very...
good for
I
you.
I want a backyard teacher. That's what I want. Somebody who's going to sit with me underneath a tree and just tell me.
Okay, breakthrough job. And this can be... it's not necessarily a career stepping stone, but... could be mowing lawns, doing laundry, something, some task or job that
okay.
Where you learn something about the world, about leadership, about all these things that we're talking about.
Okay. I would say that was a tough question. That my breakthrough job was headlining at the age of 2 in the Polynesian Review in 1967 at the Poipu Beach Hotel on Kauai.
Headlining?
Yeah. What happened was... the Hanapepe ward of the LDS Church, the Mormon Church, it was in the mid-60s, they were trying to raise funds to build their own chapel because they were worshiping out of another type of denomination. And they landed this contract to do a Polynesian Review at the Poipu Beach Hotel. And they needed some sort of lure. So
the
LDS Church.
Okay.
So they did this full Polynesian Review with the membership, you know, because there was a lot of talent that was in the church. And my grandmother had the wild idea of, hey, let's go put my 2-year-old granddaughter on stage.
Okay.
She could probably pick up and learn the hula with the rest of the big kids. So that's exactly what they did, you know. And I can still see myself in the plantation camp at my grandparents' house in Port Allen, learning these hulas aside. You know, my hula sisters, who were like 4, 5, 6 years my senior, you know, and keeping up with it. It was just an experience because I learned how to get rid of my inhibitions at a very young age.
Okay. That's what we're looking for. What was the lesson there?
Yeah.
How to get rid of inhibitions.
So, I mean, I can sell ice to an Eskimo. And
what's that?
I can sell ice to an Eskimo.
What? You said the plantation camp, Port Allen?
I grew up in a plantation camp in Port Allen, which isn't there anymore. And what it was is my grandfather was my caregiver, and he was a brilliant man. And he was taught more tutorially versus collegially. So he was more hands-on. He had a third-grade education, and he could only sign his name, you know, and that was pretty much it. And I didn't know that he couldn't read or he couldn't write until I was in high school. Because I thought to myself, this is the most brilliant man that I know. Hmm. You know, and what would basically happen is, because he was a stevedore and then he also worked on the plantation, he was able to secure a home for his family in this camp. So we were all segregated. You know, you had Filipinos here, Japanese, Hawaiian, Portuguese, Korean. But
and which group were you in?
I was in the Hawaiian group, the Hawaiian camp. And everybody in the camp, though they were of, you know, diverse ethnicities and backgrounds, there was a spirit in the camp that I still remember to this day, and I think that's why I do what I do.
But you were raised in the camp, or you were...
I say raised in the camp because during my most formidable years, you know, when you're really impacted, like from 1 to 8, I spent at my grandparents' home. You know, and this is where...
Like during the day?
During the day, the night, I practically lived there.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, I lived there about 80% of the time.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, that's why it threw me. You said your dad was in the Guard and your mom was a business person.
Yeah, well, part of that was my dad was in the Air National Guard and they were living out of, when I was first born, I don't really remember it, but they were living in this hole-in-the-wall, one-bedroom apartment, which is what they could afford, behind these overgrown bushes, because I see pictures of it, and I'm like, ew, you live there? But at the time, they were both working, and my dad, during his boot camp, of course, was shipped overseas and what have you. So majority of the time was spent at my grandmother's house.
I see. Okay. A little known fact, and this is something that even hopefully not many of your friends know.
A little known fact. I can actually be very quiet and reflective, and you chuckle, and they will as well. I'm always on. And I think it's because I love life in general, you know. And I'm sort of an extremist where I live life as every day as if it were my last, because then I have no regrets at the end of the day. But sometimes I do power down so I can reboot myself, because you can't go like this, you know, forever. But yeah, I can be quiet, just not today.
So that would surprise people?
That would surprise people
that who know you?
Yeah, because most people that know me, they know me as what you see in front of you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your mentor?
My mentor was my grandfather.
Uh-huh. What's his name?
Louis Niau.
How do you spell it?
Louis.
Uh-huh.
Louis Niau. He passed away N-I-A-U.
N-I-A-U.
A-U.
Yeah. N-I-A-U.
Niau.
No Okinas or anything?
No, that's right. It's just like that.
Is that his base?
That's his base.
Okay. And tell me again the connection to the base.
The base came to him from a cousin of his back in the early 60s, late 50s. And rumor has it that it was part of one of the original Kodak Kula shows way back when. They gave the base to him when the LDS Church got the contract. So it was played at the Poipe Beach Hotel as part of the show. And it sat in his room, and upon his passing, of all the treasures that he left behind, I think I had a connection to this one the most because it was most visual to me. But I also remember, as he was my caregiver, what I learned to do with him, because back then, you know, you didn't have video, you didn't have cartoons,
right.
He couldn't read to me, right? So what did we do? We played a lot of music. So everything that I do and I learned was because he and I would sit for hours on end and he would show me how to play all these different instruments.
So he, not just the bass, he played other...
Yeah, he played this, steel guitar, ukulele. Let's see what else. Upper bass, ukulele, steel guitar. He could do congas. I mean, he was just brilliant. There really wasn't very much he couldn't do.
That's great. And why was he your mentor? Or why do you list him as your mentor?
I realized that he was my mentor in my adulthood when he passed. Because I had a really tough time with it. And I realized why. I realized that he had actually set the first foundational tools for me. You know, he was very hands-on. I come from a family of pa'akai, or Hawaiian salt makers, from the island of Kauai. And one of the things that really jumped out at me was values, your personal value system. And he had one that was unwavering. His faith was enormous. And that's what he built for me. You know, and when I look back at my corporate career and, you know, I look back at my resume, all of it doesn't matter except for the personal value system that he taught me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, if anything, what I do is really in homage to him. Because if I can instill that same type of personal value system for someone else, you know, imagine how much more powerful the work could be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Major challenge, and this could be personal, professional, for the business, anything.
You know, that was actually a tough question for me, because I see challenges as mere roadblocks and detours on your road of life. Because ultimately, we've got the power to change the route, the car, the view, the destination. And I honestly believe that if you have faith in yourself and faith in a higher power, they will act as the ultimate shield to whatever comes at you. You know, so I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything like that, but that's what I look at as a challenge, as, ooh, okay, bring it on, you know. And then that way I can emotionally steel myself and be ready for it.
Okay. Hobbies.
Hobbies. Hobbies. What do I like to do? I like to do so much. My newest hobby is going on historic treasure hunts. And I've become somewhat of a history buff.
Mm-hmm.
So I love studying old pictures and rummaging through my grandmother's closet, you know, and my grandfather's tool shed, and finding all these little treasures. I like to read old books. And most of all, I find that I love sitting with kupuna and listening to them. And in my mind, I'm absorbing it all so that I can... I wish that I could write a book for every kupuna that I sit down with. Because there's so much experience when you sit down with them.
You're a whole history project.
I am a history project. And I also love to sing. I write music. Then I found a new love, too. I found that I love to write books. So my first one is almost finished, actually.
Oh, yeah? What kind of a book?
It's a self-help, and it's called No Matter What, 5 Steps of Reflection to Live a Balanced Life. And what I've done is, it's sort of like a, for lack of a better term, sort of like a bio story. It's I've taken 5 points of my own experience growing up on the island of Kauai with my kupuna, and I've looped it into a self-help book so that people can read my experience and then maybe pull their own into the mix so that they can empower themselves.
Okay. And books that you've recently read?
Besides my own, actually, no, I just had to proof it. The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership by John Maxwell. That's an awesome read.
21 Irrefutable Laws
of Leadership.
Okay.
By John Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Pauahi by Dr. George Kanahele. Hawaiian Antiquities by David Malo.
Okay, you're getting a little ahead of me here. Antiquities. M-A-L-O?
M-A-L-O.
Okay.
And The Eighth Habit.
Covey book?
By Stephen Covey. And The Emotional Intelligence.
Okay.
Quick book.
Emotional Intelligence?
Emotional Intelligence Quick Book.
Quick book. Who's that by?
That's by Bradbury, B-R-A-D, Barry, and Graves, G-R-A-E-V-E-S.
How do you spell Barry?
B-R-A-D-B-E-R-R-Y.
And Graves? Bradbury and Graves?
Bradbury and Graves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me a little bit about... You made a reference to your resume,
mm-hmm.
and I was reading it, and you had done quite a lot of things.
Mm. I did, and...
Tell me the route.
The route. My first job was pumping gas at Koloa Chevron on the island of Kauai. I was 15 at the time and was offered my parents owned a little car rental agency that they ran out of the Waiahai and Poipa Beach hotels before Budget and Hertz and all of that came in. And I watched them provide a level of customer service that is really not matched today. It was a real personal type of customer service. And I would always, you know, drive the cars to this Chevron station to get filled up. And we had a little charge account, you know, signed my name, and I thought I was all that. But later on, I wanted to get paid for the work that I did. And there was a help wanted sign, so I asked the owner of the station, I said, would you hire a girl? And he says, well, yeah, I've got two girls already working with me. So for a couple summers, I pumped gas. And then from there, I went to school, I came back. And right out of school, you know, of course, with the travel industry in mind, I landed the perfect job at the Stouffer Waiohae Beach Resort, which was a five diamond resort. And there I learned the intricacies of delivering five-star customer service. And I also learned very hard lessons as to why it was imperative that you do it. And what, where I'm going with this is one of my managers that to this day I really tout that he's like one of the best. His name is Kaipo Ho. He's a Ho'okipa consultant for the Outrigger Hotel. But I watched him, his lead, and just how he worked with the guests and made sure that every experience was a well-remembered one. You know, and so I think that's where I get real critical with service levels and what have you. That mm-hmm. Because you come from here, so you have that expectation, you know, that the service levels could be so much better. But I guess it's really good for my practice because then, you know, I can really help customers who are trying to build that.
Well, I guess what I was getting at is you've got you're a notary public in real estate and...
Oh, all that other
yeah.
stuff?
Yeah.
How that... Well, in a nutshell, basically what happened is...
Well, in a nutshell, say what those all those occupations were.
What they all are? Okay. From the Stouffer Waiohae Resort, at the time my dad was taking the real estate exam and he was not a math guru. So he was struggling through it, and you know, I was ribbing him all the time about, you know, why you're studying so hard, you know, so easy, blah blah blah. So he challenged me, and he says, "Well, if you think you're all that, why don't you sit for the Hawaii State Bar Exam, and let's see you pass it on the first crack, the real estate
real
exam."
Estate, yeah.
So I took him up on it. I was 18 years old, kind of arrogant at the time, right? And he's like, "I'm like, okay, bring it on," and I passed. So after that, I decided,
how
you know.
How did he do?
He didn't pass. But right, we're not gonna put that in there. And I in my mid-20s, I decided that I was going to, you know, take a stab at it. So while I was working at the hotel, I also had an active real estate license. And it was great because you could pick up clients who were visiting at the hotel.
So. Mid-late 80s, I think, popping, right?
It was right before the boom. Am I right,
right
in the boom?
Yeah.
And I actually... in 1990, decided to move back to Oahu, which I did. And at the time, I didn't know that majority of the hotels here were all union. So even though you had papers and you came with somewhat experience, you couldn't get in on a managerial level. You had to start at the bottom. And I didn't want to do that.
Really?
Yeah, it was kind of tough back then, trying to get a decent paying job.
Right.
So I decided to go back into real estate. And where that took me was becoming an office manager and administrator for a real estate company in Kailua. And then from there, once the Japanese bubble burst and the economy sort of went sour, I decided to go back to school for computers. And I was blessed enough to be picked up by a company called MLS Hawaii, which is the multiple listing
mm-hmm,
service
mm-hmm.
of real estate.
Right.
And I was a trainer and their marketing director for 5 years. So it sort of like...
What kind of a trainer?
I was a computer trainer.
Oh, computer trainer.
Yeah, so I actually taught public records, you know, how to actually search for the properties,
right.
How to read the different tax codes, you know, how to appraise, how to do competitive market analyses and all that. Did that for a while and did a demo for a company, and I guess I did well because they offered me a job after my demo. I said, well, okay, I was here to demo, but you're offering me a job. Mm-hmm. Like, well, yeah, we could use you. So I became the marketing director for First Hawaii Title. And it was actually easy for me because I had the customer service side, I had the computer training on this side, and I had a pretty good handle on the real estate industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a nice fit. And then I sort of honed my skills there by learning how to, like, do virtual tours and, I mean, you name it, and having them... aiding them in building the infrastructure and workflow systems.
Well, where did you develop the computer skills?
Well, what happened was, that was at the mid to late 90s is when technology was really booming. And the company, the head of the parent company of the First Hawaii Title, developed one of the first virtual tour programs. So what they did is we offered it as an added value for realtors. So I was the only one who, on behalf of the company, was able to learn the process of actually stitching pictures together manually, doing the voiceovers, having it link up. So I was actually doing like mini TV production, if you will.
But you were just doing it on your own. Nobody taught you.
They sat with me for 8 hours. They flew in from Arizona.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and we went through the rigmarole, and then the rest was just, here's the book, have at it. Yeah, but I'm a pretty fast learner. I'm kind of intuitive, again, and I attribute that to my grandfather. You know, look at the logic in all that you do, and you can basically figure it out.
Now, tell me about some of your clients that you've had. You have reference letters here from them, and some of them are quite well-known, Kamehameha Schools and Queen Lili'u Okalani Children's Center. What can you tell us about
that reference pack? Is so near and dear to me.
We did a Leadership Corner with Chuck Larson.
Oh, you did?
A couple weeks ago.
Oh, that's wonderful, with Seagull Schools.
Uh-huh.
I probably would not be as successful as I am or have had a chance had a gentleman by the name of Tony LeBron. He's mm-hmm. the director of the Scholars Program at Kamehameha Schools. It was by chance that he gave me my first opportunity to present my Pa'akai theory of leadership for high schoolers who were going through the Scholars Program. And that's where I actually fine-tuned the program. And when it was time for me to branch out on my own, even though my company was relatively new, my programs had already been established and were being taught for the last 2 years. Are you
really?
Looking for it?
Yes.
Yeah. So.
How did that happen?
He actually called the office looking for a trainer at the time.
I mean, how were they being taught for 2 years before?
I was actually teaching this under my former company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, with their blessing, by the way. So I had already taught this because there was only one of my predecessor, so he couldn't be everywhere.
Okay.
So he actually said, why don't you go do this? You're Hawaiian. You might be able to link up with them. So I actually developed this for Kamehameha Schools.
And what is the Pa'akai Theory?
The Pa'akai Theory is, this is a picture of me, my grandfather, and my brother, and at 16.
It's a salt pond?
Or? It's actually a ancient salt bed where salt is being created and crystallized in the sun in an ancient way. But why this picture is pretty poignant is at the age of 16, I was pretty rambunctious, and my parents decided that for a whole summer, I was going to spend it with my grandparents doing backbreaking work. Otherwise, they were going to lose me. And it was that summer that I remember where my grandfather told me, he goes, everything you do should be like making salt. And this is why. It was about hard work. I mean, it's grueling. You're on your hands and knees. You're making these salt beds. It's a process. It's the integrity of a process. You had to do it the ancient way and not, you know, breach that in any way. It was the gift that you would eventually receive, which was the salt itself. And to this day, Pa'akai, or Hawaiian salt, is like gold. You can't buy it anywhere because the rule is it must be given selflessly in for no money, because once your family sells the salt, you're out of that salt patch. So, and I'm sitting here, and I sort of had an epiphany, and this is how Kamehameha Schools comes into it. I've been commissioned to do a class on the island of Kauai, and I felt, well, wonderful, why don't we just bring the kids down there when I'm done? You know, so what I do is I use the Pa'akai Theory as the metaphor. Hard work, determination, the process, the gift, and the abundant return. I tell them about what it is, and I actually have them do exercises in class that mimics making the lo'i, or the foundation. It mimics the water transfer. I have them touch sandpaper so it they can actually feel what the sand felt like. So it's all kinesthetic, and I'm anchoring it in. And I did this class on Kauai, and I decided to bring the kids to the salt patch since we were there. And I get there about 15 minutes prior to the bus arriving, and I'm standing there, and my grandma is next to me. The wind is blowing, and it just hits me like an epiphany, and I realize that, you know, and I'm looking at her, and I'm remembering the beginning from here.
That summer.
That summer. Mm-hmm. You know, and it all kind of clicked and made sense. You know, and that's why Kamehameha Schools, I have a fond aloha for the entity, for the work that they're doing and their outreach. You know, because it's not just about Hawaiian kids, it's about a Hawaii community. And that's why I do what I do.
And what are some of the other programs you've done for some of the other groups?
For the Queen Liukalani Children's Center, I've done their yearly conferences, summer conferences called the Namamo Makamai, which is, again, children of the high school age. It's a summer program, and then I do the leadership portion of that.
Mm-hmm.
I also have done a lot of work with various companies that bring me into tailor programs unique to them for what they need. Like, it could be customer service, it could be strategic planning, mm-hmm. you know, it could be just URA meetings, you know, a burst here and there in how to align people.
Right, you mentioned some management, you know, just sort of structural organization.
Mm-hmm. Some structural organizations. I've worked with the Honolulu Federal Credit Union, like Seagull Schools, the University of Hawaii, a clerical association. It's a two-day event where every clerical person in the whole university system, they conference for 2 days. So I'm going to be their speaker for this year as well.
Speaking about what?
They do leadership and empowerment. This particular one, what I'm going to do is lean a little bit more towards the empowerment side. Because a lot of times that the jobs that they do are, they're unnoticed.
Right.
You know, but they're core. They're very vital.
Right.
You know, to the heartbeat of it all. So I'm going to do that piece and sort of try to uplift. Yeah.
So of your programs, how many, where does it fall between leadership and empowerment?
They run parallel to each other. I would say that they cross over a lot because I believe that you must be empowered in order to lead.
Right.
And so it's very difficult for me to differentiate where one ends and where one begins.
But not everybody will be a leader. That, for instance, like your
correct, because leadership, right, because leadership is something that you bring. But it doesn't mean that you cannot have leadership of self.
Mm.
You know, and the way that you operate, again, your personal value system that you create.
Now, you mentioned that these types of programs are very popular now.
They are, and you know,
why is that? Do you think?
I think my own personal thought is, in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, when that whole W. Edwards Deming,
mm-hmm.
Tiki Wham movement happened, it was very industrialized. You know, the whole Kaizen and Hoshin Kanri, and, you know, the whole team must work towards that goal, and, you know, and quality, and, you know, your customer determines what the program and the product that you deliver and all of that, which is excellent. But I think towards the 70s and the 80s, when they started doing this whole re-engineering thing, you know, oh, well, let's streamline the processes and let's multitask and let's have one person take it to fruition. For example, if you were a salesperson, you would process, you would invoice, you would collect, you would service, you would do all of that. I think during the 70s and 80s, and maybe even as early as the early 90s, we started to see a massive overload, massive layoffs, and we started to see burnout.
Mm-hmm.
People doing too much.
Right.
You know, and then that's when they started to say, well, then you've lost the heart in it all, you know, and it's true. You know, when they started doing this whole streamlining process, they may have, you know, forgotten about the human element of it. And I think now with the new gen, you know, the Gen Y, Gen Xers that are coming mm-hmm. up, they're starting to see that, you know, and like me, for example, I start to see, I'm living in, what's the word? I'm living in two worlds right now. Because I've seen the old and what it was like. I see the new. Now, how can we bridge that to make, you know, our world now
right
the way it could be?
And what are some of those characteristics that make good leaders today and for the future?
I think, in my eyes, one, and it sounds really cliche, but I still believe it. It's about honesty. It's about being able to manage oneself. Because if you can manage yourself and have the wherewithal to just be a better human being, you will, in general, be a better leader because you will be accountable for your actions. And, you know, in being able to basically step to the plate, if you are a leader, then do your job. Manage. Lead people. You know, don't let take care of the things that you need to take care of. And a lot of times, especially in Hawaii, we find that the Aloha Spirit sometimes takes over logic, you know, and we're more tolerant.
What do you mean by that?
We're more tolerant to certain behaviors, or we're more, non-confrontational.
Right.
You know, we don't want to deal, you know, we don't want to ruffle the feathers of anybody because it's such a small place. You know, but sometimes...
Well, we've got that passive-aggressive thing.
Passive-aggressive thing going on. We really do. You know, and sometimes it's okay to sort of rise to the occasion and say, hey, you know, that behavior is inappropriate. You need to do this, and this is why. And I think that's what the new generation is seeing. It's like, no more status quo. People need to be held accountable for their behaviors and their actions. You know, and it's a tough sell, especially when you've got different generations working in the same company or divisions.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the people, the baby boomers who are ready to retire, being led now by, a Gen Xer,
right,
who says, no, equality, leadership, accountability, and all this. And these guys are going, what are you doing telling me this stuff? You know, it's kind of difficult.
Do people who take your workshops, are they surprised at some of those ideals? Like, it's all about core values like integrity and honesty and things like that, as opposed, because a lot of times people who got to those positions, you know, they did it in not less than honest ways, but just, you know, it takes a certain kind of attack to get.
Well,
that sort of startle them that's what you're
I don't
about?
Think so. I think that every human being knows their threshold and their basic requirements, and sometimes we tend to forget it for whatever reason. I think that there are wonderful people in wonderful leadership positions that acquired them because they were good workers,
mm-hmm,
and they sort of evolved into those
right
positions. And perhaps maybe at the time that they were given those positions, they weren't given the necessary training or support.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's even job fit. You know, it's sometimes if you're a great technician, it doesn't mean that you're going to be a great manager.
Right.
You know, and vice versa. So the people that come to my sessions are... As with any session, not just me, it's pretty much anybody. You're going to get, you know, the people who will love you, hate you, and those who are indifferent, you know, they'll take the pieces that they need, whatever will help them, and they grow. But I think because I dare to go there, I talk about things that people don't like to talk about. I talk about the spirit. I talk about the human soul. I talk about the ability to rise above, because you can harness your own energy to do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is really no excuse. And they tend to enjoy that. It's kind of refreshing. You know, because mainstream is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you said spirit in class. Well, get over it. Okay? What does your body run on? Water and electrons? I don't think so. There's something making it work back there.
Where are the parts of Hawaiian cultural values and Western modern business or leadership, where do those parts overlap? Where do they conflict? Where are they diametrically opposed?
That's a great question. I think the cultural side of it will show the real core elements of being a good human being. It focuses on how you treat people, your obligation to others, your obligation to yourself, your work ethics, the ability to sustain your family, the ability to sustain your organization or your village or whatever. Because when you look at old style living, and you know, I'm not saying that ancient culture is like living in an ancient ahupua'a, but when I grew up in the plantation camp,
mm-hmm,
it was, to me, at that time, a modern-day version of an ahupua'a, because everybody worked towards the same goal, which is basically to survive. You know, but you had all of these, as in an ahupua'a, you had all of these experts that were experts in their own fields, you know, and what they did, and they traded their expertise for different products or services, and it ran pretty smoothly. You know, very little drama back then in those neighborhoods. So I see that. I see that ancient part of it. And then I see the Western side of it, which is, you know, it's the drive. It's achievement, it's economic achievement, you know, it's the corporate ladder, it's the whole silver lining, which is not necessarily directly opposed to the West, to the Hawaiian side, but it makes us aware that it's okay to step out of our comfort zone to want a little more, to work a little harder, you know, and it's okay if you want to go for that, to go for it.
Mm-hmm. But there's always a part where I have these conversations a lot with people where the sometimes in order to get ahead there has to be a fair amount of self-promotion and that sort of thing, which goes against the grain for a lot of folks. How do you kind of balance those things out in your workshops? Do you say you have to take off this hat and put on this one for a while, or is there some
I think the best
analogy or connection that people can use, or is it? I mean, does it have to be one or the other? That's just one example of what I'm talking about. Or you know what I'm saying? Is there a part where they can overlap, or is it always just kind of balancing the two?
I think it's about being humbly assertive.
There you go.
Yeah, that's what it is.
What does that mean?
Being humbly assertive,
yeah.
Meaning if you strive to achieve, promote, or elevate your position, your status, your whatever it is that you're working for, but you do it with benevolence, and you do it with honor and integrity, and you make sure that you don't hurt anybody in the process or do anything that basically is detrimental to your whole character.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call humble assertiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, work towards it. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but just don't be arrogant or, in essence, for lack of a better term, and I don't know if I can say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, don't be a butthead about it. You know?
Right.
Humble assertiveness, that's what I would call it.
What are some of the common, I don't want to say issues, but maybe impediments or issues that people bring both to, I'm interested in both the leadership and the empowerment. What are some of the more common traits you see that people need to either, I don't even know if overcome is the right word, but, you know, to deal with?
Especially in Hawaii,
yeah.
On the leadership side, because Hawaii is so aloha, so friendly, so passive, what we're finding is, you know, I speak for myself, and I'm sure for my predecessor and my kumus, actually, I have several, is that because of our non-confrontational way of life,
uh-huh.
It's difficult to address behavioral issues or operational issues that need to be addressed.
Right.
And when those issues aren't addressed, it starts to infest the workplace, the division, the organization. And it just, we end up having to deal with managing people and their behaviors more than managing the task at hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
the
operational part of it, yeah, because we're dealing with the drama.
Right.
When we should just be operating, okay, well, this is the issue, let's deal with it, let's take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're segueing into all these other things. So that's one issue that comes to
so
us.
So the leaders get distracted by the politics of the issue rather than...
I think that the leaders are trying to do the right thing as best as they can without disrupting the
mm-hmm.
whole.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, in order to do the right thing, is to disrupt the whole, the whole organization or the division that's being affected. You know, but sometimes it's very difficult because again, Hawaii is just so small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you put yourself out there, you know, as the martyr to fix this one issue, and how will it come out? You know, and it's difficult. It's really difficult. I know seasoned leaders that are challenged with it. You know, because how do you do it? And we've become such a litigious society where in the past, again, I'm living in two worlds where you could actually tell somebody, hey, that's not right what you're doing. you know, they might now to say, hey, that's not right. You've got to come, you know, you've got this legalese that you have to actually contend with.
Right. You know. But I guess among the people that come to your leadership workshops, are there some personality issues? Are there some value issues that are, in other words, if they come to your workshop, and is there a...
I think I know what you're asking me. What's the takeaway, or what have I seen as some of the takeaways from these sessions?
Well, I guess I'm asking a question so that when people read it, they'll go, oh, I have some of those things in me that if I can just overcome them, discuss them, get them out, whatever they are, maybe that would help me elevate. And I don't recognize that until somebody like you points it out.
Okay. I think what I'm seeing a lot of is a lot of people with too much on their plates.
Mm.
And it's stemming from the influx of technology, mm-hmm. where, you know, the first thing that they see when they get to their office, that's just the wind, the first thing that they see is, you know, 50 emails, 20 voicemails, their cell phone's going off,
right.
You know, and they're having to contend with that.
And everything has to be done now.
Exactly. And then, you know, then they've got their Outlook kind of beaming at them. And at some point, and then, of course, everybody is running real lean and mean right now. And they're trying to juggle all of that while raising a family,
mm-hmm.
you know, and trying to have some sort of personal balance.
Right.
And what I've tried to do is, one, empower them to know first that they can do it. Two, is give them some systems and some tools to help them prioritize,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps maybe realign,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of their daily tasks,
right.
so that they can have a little bit more breathing time. And some of the sessions that I offer are also taught by affiliate trainers who are experts in their field. And one of the experts, that's just the wind. It's like, it kind of sounds like an old tree.
Yeah.
One of the experts that we've got is a psychologist by the name of Dr. Caroline Sakai. She served as Kaiser Permanente's head of clinical psychology for 31 years. And she teaches a class based on thought field therapy, which is using the meridian points of the body, like acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
but using a series of tapping techniques, you can actually get the same result as you would from acupuncture without the needles. So we can actually teach stress reduction, anxiety, peak performance, all of that through different types of holistic mm-hmm. techniques. And I think that's what people are looking for right now. They're looking for more balance. They're looking for more breathing time.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to refocus on the more important things.
Right.
Which is more their families.
Interesting.
Really?
So they go to a leadership workshop and learn how to
focus
more time on their family.
They go to leadership and they... Because I honestly believe that without family or ohana, you really have nothing.
Uh-huh.
So I think that if you put the most important first, everything else is gravy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there things people can do, though, if they read this article about looking inward about issues that they might need to address, other than, I mean, most people know they have too much,
you know,
stuff on their plate, things that they might not be aware of, or things that they go to the workshop, they go, oh, that's me. I didn't realize I do that, or... Are there some common things you see?
Yeah, I think people who realize that they can empower themselves to achieve certain goals that they've got, if they can harness that energy to push them, because humans just love completion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I teach them something as simple as doing a daily to-do list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because just people just love checking off things.
Right.
You know, and something as simple as that time management,
right.
you know, makes a world of change can affect, you know, just something as simple as that. And I see a lot of that. So when I come in, we hear a lot of, I don't have enough time, I have stress,
right.
Too much responsibility, no time for myself.
It's part of the problem you touched on. It's part of it that some people don't have those goals anymore. In other words, you've become president of the company, or your division head, and that was your goal, but now, you know, you're not going to move any higher or you're satisfied. Is that?
Yeah. No, I think it's different for different people, but I think what happens is, depending on the role that you've got, it may require more energy out of you that you weren't anticipating.
Right.
And you may have taken on the role thinking that you had the energy and wherewithal to do it, but, you know, with the way the world is kind of going, you know, work with less and give me more.
Yeah.
You know, there's an imbalance there somehow.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to say? I've taken up way more of your time than I...
Oh, no. I guess it's just I hope that people will realize that before we are triggered to think about our mortality and all of the things that we wish we did or the changes we wish we had made, I hope that we start to think about it and act upon it when we're healthy and able, and not wait until something dramatic happens that forces us to do it. Because if we can start to live every day again like it was our last, then we would probably all be much more happier human beings in the long run.
That's interesting. Okay.